This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm your host, Daniel Shea, and this is another episode of The Focus All We Mean, an ongoing discussion and debate about how we mean and why. The premise of the podcast is that meaning production and the products of meaning making are pretty much everything there is for us humans. As a species, we do not encounter a thought or a thing, not even ourselves, without us going and making meaning with it, or adding meaning to it. Meaning is how we act as much as it is why we do. And so the subject matter of this focus reaches into absolutely every quarter of human life, our daily routines, our career paths, our bids to acquire new knowledge, our attempts at connecting with or at disconnecting from one another. The format of All We Mean is simple. I open every episode by stating plainly the topic, and then my guests take up this topic to discuss it and debate it in the hope that we all might learn something more about meaning. The topic of today's episode is a revisit. Once more, what does it even mean for a machine to be generative? And for that, I'm going to read a text prepared by one of my guests today, James G. But first, to these guests, I welcome back Bill Cope and Mary Calanzes, professors at the University of Illinois. And today I welcome to the program James G., Regents Professor, and Mary Lou Fulton, Presidential Professor of Literary Studies at Arizona State University. So, welcome to all of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah.
So, to our topic, again, the meaning of generative and generative AI, or generally an ML. And to get that talk started, I'm going to read the short text that Jim has provided for me. And here goes. ChatGPT-4 operates more similarly to humans than many people believe. A massive amount of human thought and action is carried out unconsciously. Brain imaging techniques have revealed that decisions can be predicted based on neural activity before individuals are consciously aware of making a choice. In many cases, the idea we freely and consciously make a choice is something of an afterthought. The human unconscious brain can, as in the case of chat, do its job well only if it has very big data. The brain is constructed for the most part from experience. Each experience we have in life connects or disconnects neurons in our brain. At any one point in time, the brain will be a complex system of neurons that excite or deactivate one another in large connected systems. These patterns of excitation and deactivation are the ways the brain processes, learns, and decides. The unconscious system in humans is the source of intuition, as well of a good deal of human insight and creativity. Intuition is the ability to understand something immediately without the need for processes of conscious reasoning. For example, we all know the case where a scientist, mathematician, or artist has worked a great deal on a problem with conscious effort, only then later to hit, almost as if by chance, on a good solution or an elegant outcome when they are no longer directing at the problem any of their attention at all. The bottom line is, the human brain is a prediction engine based on stored experiences and often operates on automatic pilot, with conscious reasoning coming on later as an afterthought. Generative AI is not that different, and so has a great deal to teach us about the nature of human beings. End quote. So, well, that is, if I look back over some of our All We Mean sessions, a slightly different take on things. Maybe I'll hand the stage to Bill or to Mary to sort of respond in the stance here that we've just seen on generative AI.
Well, I just want to first say it's wonderful to have Jim back in the conversation with us. And I remember so many years ago in New London when we got together to talk about meaning and what it meant as the new technology and the multiplicity of human interests, you know, unfolded. And here we are now engaging with the machine in a way that perhaps we didn't quite anticipate. And it's interesting to hear Jim want to bring the human continuity into it.
So look, let me just make a comment about this, that what's interesting is that this generative stuff strings together absolutely coherent sequences of words. But the way in which it does it is very, very different from the way humans do. So, you know, one of the problems in the whole artificial intelligence area is just the idea of artificial intelligence, to be quite frank, which is the idea that machines can replicate human brains. That's written all the way through all the metaphors that are used, neural nets and brain metaphors are used all the way through. But I'll just give one little example of this. That let's take the phrase "my great big fat." The Greek wedding movie. It's my
great big fat Greek wedding.
Interestingly, I'm struggling with that. Right? But one of the things is the way humans order multiple adjectives is. I was thinking about this yesterday and I looked it up. I'll tell you what it is. It's opinion, size, age, shape, color, origin, material, purpose. There is an order where it feels wrong if you put things in a different order, which is actually a semantic order. Whereas all the GPT can do, it'll get that word ordering right, but it's not a theoretical way of thinking. I mean, humans have implicitly, even if it's unconscious, the theoretical way of thinking of ordering those adjectives, right? Which is part of our unconsciousness, if you like, Jim. But nevertheless, we do it in a sense grammatically. Whereas what all the GPT has is a whole lot of empirical words, and it's the word "my fat great big whatever." It's those empirical words that it aligns statistically in a way that a human brain could never do, and should never do. So one of our arguments is that we keep on making these analogies between computer and machine intelligence, and although the effect might be the same, which is to string those words together correctly, the way in which humans do it is very different from machines.
Well, so I obviously don't agree with that. The human brain's a prediction engine, and it makes those predictions based on a wealth of data, huge from experience, and the web of associations with each other. And it isn't, so prediction means probability, right? The brain is computing probabilities, not with any central processor, but with a set of associations. And then it selects but what to say from that, and then it makes judgments whether it's working, and then it rearranges the probabilities, which is why it's Bayesian, as I've said. So they work in a similar way. When Bill says we think in terms of semantics or theory, we don't really know what that means. That those are folk terms. What's going on in the brain is different. what's striking is that humans, when they process anything, certainly language, a tremendous amount of it is unconscious and not even available to consciousness. And then there's a bit of it that the brain allows to go to the conscious part of the brain, and we can articulate overtly and consciously. Weirdly, the chat can articulate everything it processes, right? Because all it is language. It can put it into language, everything it processes. So when a human discovers unconsciously a really important pattern in experience, they can't always say what it is. They can act on it, they can anticipate it, but they can't always articulate it. But see, chat can always articulate any pattern he finds, which is why, for example, he just recently discovered whole new sets of biological cells and how they operate, right? That's weird. So I'm not arguing chat and humans behave the same. I'm saying that by looking at how chat actually operates and what modern neuroscience has said, we can learn more about human beings. Some we're going to learn make us very different from AI. For example, that we use emotions to judge and assess our actions and thoughts, and chat has no emotions. And some are going to make us rethink how different we are from a machine.
Right. What about the hallucination there, Jim? How does that fit in with this ultra consciousness, if you like, of chat?
Well, first of all, chat hallucinates less and less as it gets better. You have to realize we're dealing with a baby here. Chat 4 was infinitely better than 3. 5 will be better. Claude 3 has just come out way better than Claude 2, almost as good as chat 4. So we're looking at the just things that change very fast. So they hallucinate less. On the other hand, of course, humans hallucinate all the time. Just listen to Trump talk. We can produce absolute weirdness based on, you know, having associations in our brain that are crazy, but that interact with our talk and we say it. So again, I bet chat hallucinates differently than humans, but the real issue is, remember, humans are not tropic to truth. They're not trying to produce truth. They're trying to produce things that make them feel good, make sense, make them feel that they matter, so that they keep their mental health. That's not why chat produces stuff.
Right. But Jim, same and similar, right, is, you know, we have to unpack that. And that ChatGPT cannot continue without human. That baby, it's not just the technology that's improving the way in which it harvests human content, but it needs humans to keep feeding it for it to grow. So I do think there is some need to separate out what is the same and what is similar.
Right, I agree with that. By the way, it's not clear in the future it'll need humans, because if you interconnected several or hundreds or thousands of AIs with basic central systems and to each other, they would teach each other, and they may or may not need a human being. Right now, they certainly do need a human being.
So look, let me go back to what it is underneath the hood, so to speak. So there's this nice phrase, bag of words, which was invented by Paris, which was Chomsky's supervisor. And that, firstly, the GPT stuff can only deal with words. So let me just say what words are. Words in the modern world is anything that can be expressed in Unicode. That's all that operates, all that happens inside this space. And that includes, by the way, computer code and mathematical notation, because they're expressed in Unicode, as are emojis, by the way. So computer code is 130,000 characters. And beneath that is binary notation. So each of those characters is differentiated because beneath that is binary notation. So all it can do is calculate. And yes, it may be Bayesian calculation, But it does one thing which no human can do, which it has now every recorded word down the back of it, and no human can operate with that. And it has the spatial relationship of every word to every other word, which involves very fine semantic nuances, because each word, and the word, it's token, not word, which is slightly less than a word, but these are semantic units, which are simply collocations of bits of Unicode behind which is binary notation. Now, one of the things that happened was this, what was the breakthrough? The breakthrough was in 2017 to build the Vasani paper, which was to build a kind of the transformer architecture, which made this statistically manageable, right? So even with all the computer power in the world, and, we've got these NVIDIA chips doing crazy things now, moving very fast, every word computer, every other word's a big calculation. And the compression mechanism that was thought up was this statistical process, which is called the transformer. Attention's all you need was the article. Now, the thing is that human beings operate in a very different kind of way, because we need compression mechanisms. The world is empirically infinite. There's an infinite number of words, an infinite number of sensations, infinite number of things that might happen, and we need compression mechanisms. And so this is the point where we would go back to Halliday's notion of grammar, which is a grammar as a theory of the world. So what we do with humans is we don't operate statistically or in a Bayesian kind of way. Yes, of course, our experience is partly phenomenologically empirical, yes, but we make sense of that experience theoretically. And in a sense, the sentence is a very good example of a piece of theory, which is you've got a subject and an object, you've got nouns and verbs, and we also, when it comes to multiple adjectives, like I said before, have these subtle variations whereby we classify things in the order of those words. And behind that is a theory of the world. And behind it is kind of essentially a semantics, right? Which is the theory of the world is a semantics.
Which produces Trump ideology.
Well, that's another problem. But, the thing is that the argument is these are very different processes. And what's the way in which the GPT creates a coherent text, which is pretty spectacular, to be quite frank. No one's arguing that. And world-shattering. And, our argument is this is at least as big as the as movable type in the history of human communication. It's a massive achievement. But nevertheless, the underlying processes are very, very different, right? And therefore, and we need to understand those differences to understand how hallucination, for example, happens. So the hallucination in GPT is very different from Donald Trump's hallucinations. And we need to know that difference in order to be able to interpret what's going on. So that's our kind of read of this thing. Jim, what do you reckon?
So I still don't agree with a lot. One of the things that makes this difficult is we know a little bit or a fair amount about what's going on inside these generative AIs. We know much less about what's actually going on inside the human brain. We know that the brain processes each sense separately in its own language, and then eventually puts them all into a joint language where the final processing step, the brain cannot tell which sense the information came from. Okay. So that means there is a common language for all the senses used in one step of the processing. The other thing is that the generative AIs induce grammar. They don't have grammar rules. They induce it from the data. Now, remember, Chomsky argued no machine, no human could induce the rules of grammar from actual data, because there were universal parts of language that are simply specified. ChatGPT rarely makes a grammatical mistake, certainly never breaks language universals. And if you ask GPT, how do you manage that? He'll say, I don't have a grammar, but I induce grammatical properties. Long ago, the sort of neural net that's under chat was a much simpler version, was given just data of sounds from a language and asked, as you got this correctional feedback, to induce the phonological structure of the language, to get the right set of phonemes and their right phonetic features. And it did so after all of us. So now, in fact, it actually did it a little bit better than linguists. And then the machine is operating with this induced knowledge of a phonological system. Now, it's operating with it. It's not representing it directly. It's operating with it, though, as induced knowledge. And it's not clear to me that grammar isn't induced knowledge in humans.
But isn't it framed up by humans?
No. In the phonological example, it's framed by humans because you asked a question. You said, here are the phonetic facts about just sound. And given that the lexicon works this way in minimal pairs, what are the set of phonemes and the phonetic features that can make them? And, you know, linguists had different theories, and it came up with a theory very similar to Chomsky and Halley, but a little bit better. So, yeah, the humans are in this. I'm not arguing that it can operate on its own, right? It's an assistant to humans, right. But it's an assistant that bears not only some similarity to humans, but that makes us ask, do we really know about ourselves what we think we know?
Yeah, but you're only talking about the content there. I mean, I'm talking about the way it's framed up to operate and continuously being improved by humans who do the framing and are in the background.
But Mary, you're continuously being proved by humans. Your brain makes associations out of your experience, tests them against experience, and the data is from other people in the world. So you get smarter and smarter because people keep inputting more data to you.
Sure,
and without that,
I'm not talking about the content. I'm talking about the technical framing and reframing that happens by an army of technical people who are shaping and controlling what we think is natural.
Well, the shaping and controlling is that they give it feedback whether it's right or wrong.
And they do
shape it. I'm not sure in language acquisition and interaction life, aren't I shaping the responses I want from you?
No.
Yeah, there are meta prompts with
we
people.
Design for recipients to to respond to us in certain ways.
No, this is a machine, and the machine is being constructed and reconstructed all the time. That's what I'm saying, not about its content. I understand that about its content, but in terms of the way that it technically operates, it is manufactured by technical people, not users, who keep shaping it. You know, they keep taking out the bias, for example, or they put it in, or, you know, they determine the way it's going to operate. We can't say yet that it can improve or function in the world without that kind of input.
And by the way, it does nothing without prompts. So in other words, it's only a kind of purely mechanical response to prompts. And there are also meta prompts. People have broken in and found the meta prompts, which is only speaking
right.
these and blah, 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 blah.
Again, I'm just not sure there aren't analogs that to human beings. We don't do anything but are prompted from the world, from the data we get from the world and our senses. We are in a feedback loop with the world.
Yes, no, there are analogs, but the argument we're making is that the processes are interestingly and fundamentally different. Just one small point, though, about phonology. In a way, this GPT universe and the whole AI universe doesn't deal with phonology at all. It only does phonology in a secondary kind of way, which is I want this thing spoken to me or I want to ingest the material via speech. But then what it does, it breaks everything down into Unicode, and the Unicode is chunked into semantic tokens. So it has no meaning at all beneath the level of a token. So the units are written semantic units, and the sources are all textual sources, even if those sources have been transposed out of oral discourse. But nearly all of it's not oral discourse. The reason why it sounds like a damn, you know, sort of kind of
vanilla.
poor poor essay is because its sources are essentially written sources. One of the really interesting things about this in terms of a theory of multimodality is that everything it does, like things phonological and things visual, for example, images, is all secondarily connected to text. In other words, what we're doing, it's a big, it is the Gutenberg 2. It's movable type 2.
In a sense it is, but look, an image is in the human brain. It's not an image. It's represented by types of code. And actually, we know from many different translations in different codes, some of which are just germane to visual information, some of which are put together, integrated with the other senses. So the underlying thing in both a human brain and this doesn't look like the stuff we see.
But I think the point that Bill might be making, if I might weigh in on that, is coming back to, you know, grammar as a theory of the world. The idea that there is, you know, in there, and Bill is a merry sense of the word, an interest in what we do. I mean, you had said, Jim, that, you know, chat induces grammar from data. So, I mean, it's excellent at formalism in a way that we couldn't be. Is it then not possible to say that humans use grammar and make more data? So in other words, it's like we want something, a machine doesn't.
Well, certainly the machine doesn't want anything. I've already conceded that it doesn't have emotions or things like desire. But, you know, it does have a semantic representation. So I believe, both of us believe, grammar is a theory of the world. We just think differently what that theory is. Grammar is, to me, an ontology. It's a basic structure of the world that then you riff on by situational meanings. And chat has a multi-dimensional representation of semantic concepts done in terms of what things are not, much like Saussure suggested, but in more than multiple dimensions. And the bigger it gets, the more dimensions, the more connections. And that is a set of large semantic network of points, just points in a multidimensional space, that then language can attach a label to so that it represents some sort of basic category. And then in practice, in communication, that category is nuanced into multiple meanings in context, right? So you have a separation between structure, which is abstract and categorical, and meaning in the ground of practice, which is situational, contextual, non-categorical. And actually, I think this separation of these two in the brain is a genius of evolution.
All right, a couple of things about the brain. One is clear that it doesn't operate with undifferentiated binaries, which this stuff does. Dig down to the bottom, it's undifferentiated binaries, represented literally in binary notation, and that then works its way out to Unicode as the basic character set, and then tokens beyond that as a way of holding the semantics together. But again, the argument is that GPT ends up being theoretical, but only by way of some Bayesian conclusion. It's not because it's able to be theoretical and operate meaningfully itself. It's only just simply this giant empiricist machine, which the brain's not. I mean, the brain, you know, we do a whole pile of synthetic things. It's not just, neurons, you know, as these zero and one binary things, which end up doing calculations. We end, our system of making order in the world has a kind of a theory which it imposes. GPT has no theory. It ends up accidentally with a theory by virtue of the outcome of its calculations.
I don't know what you mean by a human has a theory. How is that theory stored in the brain? It's not stored necessarily in language.
It's not in language at all. So our argument is that it's absolutely not in language. So the language centeredness of all our understandings and research is absolutely flawed. It's centered in a world where we understand, let's say, something like action. We understand action both as words and as embodiment and as is space and is visual and blah, blah, blah. It's the multimodality argument. So what we do is we have this underlying thing. There are things in the world, right, which we call reference in this grammar we've been working on. There are things in the world to which we reference. There are actions which we call agency. There are, and so on. There is interest, which is a sense of directionality and purpose. And these things are represented multimodally and sensorily. Embodiment and language itself is only one of a many transpositions possible across these different forms of meaning.
And we're representing it in our conversation right now.
Oh yeah, of course. but see, you prompt chat, you talk to him. In some sense, he understands in that he can respond appropriately, right?
No, it just does a calculation off your prompt. So what it does, it takes the words in your prompt and does a sum. It just simply goes back and way back.
Well, I think that's way too simple. It's doing a sum with a large amount of context and computed probabilities that change with as you do it more, and using a semantic network in multiple spaces. So it's not quite that simple. My argument is that it's like a human mind, except the human mind is infinitely more complex, but that we don't have a little thinker inside of us and a little seer inside of us that thinks in terms of words or images. We have inside of us a network of associations that ultimately become what we call thoughts or ideas or images.
But what if this might give us different perspectives on what we're talking about here. If we exit the brain and go out into the system, and we'll just stay at language for now, will there be, through the use of chat or in chat's language system, language change and language variation? I mean, because that is exactly what we have seen from evidence and will expect in the use of language by humans. So this might be a variable outside of the brain.
It learns from your responses more and more. In fact, Claude's going to do this much more. So just like with people, as it interacts with different people, different users, it will learn new things that could change language, that could change its language.
But it can only learn new things off recalculating the relationships of legacy text which has been put into. It can't actually think new things. One of our
isn't that kind of Bakhtin's view? I mean, I agree that this, right now chat is too text-based. But Bakhtin is saying, you're regurgitating all the stuff you've been exposed to and then adding your own slant. So that you're speaking through the database of society, culture, your lived experience. And because you're unique, there is both a unique aspect to what you're saying, but there also is you're riffing on the input, much bigger than chat, that of culture and society. To me, chat's kind of a mildly Bakhtinian child.
It's not
riffing on the cultural stuff it's been fed. It doesn't have quite as unique a spin as many humans have, but it is riffing on what it has. It's ventriloquating the textual evidence of culture.
No, all it has is the textual evidence of culture, the textual evidence. Let's stick to the text. That's all it has, legacy textual evidence. What if there's something new to be discovered in the world, which is discovered by embodiment, discovered by experiment, discovered by emotion, discovered by interest, discovered by So in other words, it's irretrievably a reprocessor of written text written in Unicode, right? That's all it is, and it cannot go beyond that. Now, what it might do is come up with some interesting insights that might create new poetry in iambic pentameter, which nobody's seen before, but it's only because it's got a pile of examples and a pile of from the purely narrowly textual data. So in other words, all it can do now for that, it's an amazing machine, incredible. No one's going to deny that. But that is also its absolute limits.
Right now, but we can imagine
forever,
eventually processing videos, actions.
Well,
the work of Fei-Fei Li is already pushing in this direction. So that's the limitation of where this thing started. After all, we're talking about things that were made to be textual. Whether that's an ultimate limitation, I don't know. It's certainly, I argued, and I agree with you completely, it will never be able to answer your criticism unless it gets a body.
Okay, good point. Yeah, nice.
And we can't prompt, share any prompts with you that will force you to respond to us in a particular way that we would find more acceptable.
Let me take this moment. We're about halfway.
We're human.
We're about halfway through. I've been jotting notes as I listen, and I've come up with basically five differences, which I'm going to run down in keyword type phrases, between chat and humans, and maybe that will jog us into a new direction or get out some new ideas. We began with this idea of consciousness and its ultra-conscious abilities to chat as opposed to humans. And I kind of line that up also with its excelling at formalism, where I would say we humans tend to be functional. You know, we want something, we want to get something done. We've conceded that there's emotion in humans, not in chat. We've talked about the technical text base or basis, whereas we have a multimodal basis in the human. We're waiting for the body to be given to chat, we just said. We've talked about interest, basically that you have an intention, right? And you're doing something. And I still cling on to, and I'm just throwing it out there once more, this idea of in the system there being change and variation, which to me seems to be the one distinguishing characteristic of natural language.
Well, there's variation from chat 3 to chat 4. Now, again, Mary's going to say people did that, but people do language variation by getting each other to accept something that wasn't previously acceptable.
And then it catches on. That's called social, not mechanic. Remember, to going back to what is similar.
The question
is
how it happens, essentially. Right. So in other words, the analogies are all true. And my goodness, it writes, it seems like it's a brain. But, you know, one of the things is, so the analogies are all powerful. The question is, are the analogies and the metaphors true to the underlying mechanisms? That's the really important point.
And the other part of it, I mean, we've tried to understand that. That's what we're putting our minds to, and we've also tried to come up with a new grammar for this time, both for understanding natural language and understanding what this is doing. We kind of need tools to be able to interpret the way that it makes meaning and humans make meaning.
So, you know, a couple of points is, one is you mentioned that it has ontologies. I mean, one of our arguments is that it only has ontologies by statistical accidents, not because it's got a kind of theoretical framework that it's operating with, whereas we as humans operate with these ontologies, either a high-level ontology in the Hallidayan sense or particular ontologies like we have for medicine. It has no way of dealing with whether something is factual or not, hence the hallucination bullshit stuff as well. So in other words, you know, what we've got to do is say that in a technology which simply is about the rehashing and the recalculation of the statistical relationship of words, what are things it will never be able to do, so long as there's that technology? Yes, if we grow it a body and we grow it a brain, well, that's another universe. We're not talking about that. We're simply talking about something which reduces legacy accessible digitized text to Unicode and then to binary annotation. That's all we're talking about.
Well, it's not all. It's got things like Twitter in it, and it's got more and more oral data as we have it. So it's not all, it's certainly texts of all different types, right, including some that are records of speech. So it knows a lot about registers, linguistic registers, stylistic.
Right. It doesn't know about phonology. But it doesn't know about phonology. It doesn't know about prosody. It doesn't know about, can't know any of that stuff. And it doesn't know any of that stuff.
You have to tell me what it means to say humans know phonology. They only know it unconsciously, and we don't know how the brain stores phonemes. And if you aren't literate, you don't have any conscious knowledge of phonology. You don't know what a phoneme is. So when you say humans know stuff, it's not clear what that means at the level of the brain. And that's why I agree with Mary. What we should be doing is trying to find a common theory that we can talk about both these things and animals, because they have intelligence, yeah, right, and then look at what this universe is with some shared assumption, so we can not prejudice the human because we're humans.
Yes, but the complexity of the human means we don't know much about its brain, but we do know and can clearly articulate how this ChatGPT is manufactured.
We do know it's manufactured, but everybody agrees that at the level of which the neural network now is so big and the data is so big, it has emergent properties, and the people who make this stuff, like OpenAI, do not know exactly why it does what it does. It's an emergent property. We don't understand how it does it. Some people are quite surprised by what it does. So at that level, just like us, we're a complex system, and they complex systems have emergent properties that aren't the sum of their parts. So knowing the sum of its parts is not a good way to predict what it'll do, because it's a complex system.
That's fine. I agree with that, but it's not the same. And it's really
nobody's important. Saying it's the same. We're saying that they're more similar than we think, because we have a lot of folk theories. Like, for example, we think humans have free will. There is absolutely no way to establish humans have free will. Most of the evidence is that it's a false concept. It's a necessary one to run society. But in fact, there's just no source of what one could understand about the brain. You know, a book determined by Robert Spolsky just came out. It's very controversial, but he gives reams of evidence that the concept of free will makes no sense if you're talking about it as a mechanism in the body or the brain. If you're talking about it as a social concept connected to our language and behavior, then it makes sense.
Yeah, right. It can't make love and reproduce children.
That it can't do. And
This brings us to generative.
If humans had done less of that, we'd be in a lot of better shape.
No, this is Mary brings up a very apropos point here. I mean, we are talking about generative, so generation, and I mean, okay, yes, it doesn't make babies, and we're not talking really about that. But I am interested in this idea of it's creating and us creating. I think in this last point about free will, we've delved deep down inside of the mechanisms, either of the brain or the chat, and seen that, you know, let's say categorically, we can't necessarily make differences, maybe more complexity, but more of the same. But on the social level that you've just mentioned there, Jim, and that we've been talking about a lot in other aspects here, you know, I mean, chat doesn't have a society. It doesn't have a community. It doesn't have a belongingness, does it?
But it has owners who do funny things, though, and it has companies that are going to make a shit pile of money out of it,
ones we should be worried about.
And that's what we should be worried about, yeah, really.
Yeah, but if we're generating something, if a human is generating something, you know, even if it's just, you know, for selfish reasons or for approval or for whatever, if the human, the he or the she or the they, thinks, you know, okay, I'm going to decide to do something, maybe they can't decide, but you know, on that social level, I'm going to decide I'm going to help this person and so on. I mean, they've produced an act, they've moved in a way, they've offered an object and so on, all sorts of generation which lie outside the scope of chat.
They can't do that, because what generates your action, and you couldn't act if you didn't have it, is feeling and emotion. Because you can't even you couldn't pick what to wear in the morning unless at some level you cared more about one piece of clothing than another. Otherwise, and by the way, there's evidence for people who lose this, they can't act at all. And so what generates action is in humans, and what assesses the action, tells you whether to repeat it or do something different, is feeling, emotion, affect. And the unconscious operating of the brain. And chat has none of those. It has no unconscious. It can say everything it computes. And it has no emotion. So by definite, so this is where I think we learn that the fundamental thing is not that humans have an ontology and chat doesn't, they both do. And it's both probably a representation of multidimensional space. But chat hasn't got is a body. And it hasn't got the thing that could assess action and give it desire.
But look, let me just say one thing about the free will argument, which is you're saying that these GPTs have as much, they're as determined as human beings are, and there is in the sense that humans don't have free will. Look,
oh, I'm not saying humans are determined. We're not deterministic. We're complex systems, so you could never predict what we'll do. And that we're determined is different than saying we don't freely choose. Our choices are activated by a whole part, many, many parts of our brains, emotions interacting and issued without us knowing fully why we decided what we did.
But look, if there is such a thing as not complete free will, there is such a thing as responsibility. So in other words, I could choose to vote one way or another. I might decide the liberal democratic system is kind of flawed and why would you bother voting one way or another, but I can actually go and vote one way or the other. And I can have a set of opinions to back that up and then a set of responsibilities for having voted that way if things turn out in a particular way. So there is scope in human beings for some degree of political possibility, a range of possibilities where you choose to join one side or another. These machines can't do that. And in fact, what they do is they have people manipulating to do that. The farcical thing last week where they overcompensated in Gemini for all the DEI stuff. And, it started creating female presidents in the United States when there hadn't been any and whatever. So in other words, what's interesting is the forms of, they are absolutely, if they have worldviews or ontologies, which, my ontology will allow me to vote in a particular way when it comes to what I perceive my interests to be, right? It's been purely programmed in. All right, so it is very, very different. The scope for response, the scope for action, and therefore the place to which you source responsibility with humans and a machine is very, very different.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But what we were talking about is how you think about the human brain and chat in terms of theories of grammar. And theories of how we generate, in Chomsky sense, generate, not babies. And that is, what system can produce the set of acceptable sentences and what has to be in it and what is it, can it be done totally by data or do you have to pre-specify?
And our argument is, and this is one of the rare points we probably had with Chomsky, well, the disagreement with Chomsky is that it's not biologically written to the brain, that this is something that young children learn, is that the way in which you manage a complex world is with grammar as a theory of everyday life, whereas the machine operates in a purely Bayesian way, massive high-level empiricism. We're theoretical animals. That machine is a purely empirical machine. And by the way, the amount of data it's got, no human being could deal with or would want to deal with. And certainly couldn't deal with it and wouldn't want to deal with it via the kinds of statistical pattern matching processes that it uses. Now, I'm not saying that a lot of what we've learned isn't learning from empirical experience, but we condense that empirical experience into a theory of the world, which then allows us to deal with, to deal with the complexity, essentially. So the mechanisms of dealing with complexity are fundamentally different. That's what we're saying.
And for us, Jim, this matters to us, not just as, kind of an issue of interest, but we're educators working in educational institutions. What do we do with it? How do we understand how it's different from what it is to be human? But how do we harness those differences in a productive way or understand what might not be productive? I mean, that for us now, and every educational institution has to address that rather than pretending it doesn't matter.
So I think that's a much more important question. I think that to me, chat is another new technology like literacy, like print, and the internet, social media. And what we've seen with all of these technologies is they transform the world. They have great potential for good, and they have great potential for harm. Right. And then humans get their hands on them. The bad guys almost always do better than the good guys at using the technology.
No, we agree on that completely.
We agree completely. And that's, you know.
And partly because it requires I always say, look, this is still industrial capitalism, and that it requires a lot of electricity and very big factories to run these damn things.
Right. I think that issue is going to be the Achilles heel, quite frankly, because I live in a state full of server farms in the rural areas.
Right.
And we've just discovered the demand of these server farms will be 17 times more electricity than Phoenix has can produce.
Yes. I mean, this is also just water. This was just covered by the New Yorker. Bitcoin technology, cryptocurrencies, and the generative AI. I think the recent figure was something like 6% of electricity use in America goes to that.
Sam Altman is trying to raise $1 trillion to put up more server farms and chip factory, so there is. Given that we are getting towards the end of the finite resources of the world, and I don't think AI has a future much longer than humans, and we probably have 40 years.
That's even grimmer than the first part of our conversation, but you might be right. A weird moment, really, for those of us who have to use this stuff. And I notice, Jim, in our students, and we have a lot of them, are using it very quickly, but for very mundane, ordinary, procedural reasons. You know, they're not solving cancer, or maybe some people are using it, but the quick use of it is to make lists, to make a PowerPoint,
that's what people do with most technologies. Right. People use them trivially.
Yes.
We're doing work right now on how chat can transform the way we teach registers, how you match function form and content and get people to have meta awareness of language. It's a really rich tool for that if you use it correctly. And it would give us another much deeper genre movement, because it can exemplify, translate, and allow you to see models and then even interact with you in those models. So if we wanted people to learn academic registers and so-called academic language and understand how registers work in the world, this is a powerful tool.
Yes.
But we can use it for trivial stuff as well.
Right. But genre is exactly the point. I mean, it does the genre very well. And we are trying to harness it in order to enable our students to engage with genre in relation to purpose rather than to a bag of words.
Well, look, you can say it has no purpose. It doesn't have desires. But remember, in a kind of Wittgensteinian way, the things it produces appear to have a purpose in the way they can be consumed by humans.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what goes on in your head. I don't care what your intention is privately. I don't even know if you have one. I induce that from what you say and from our shared experience. I think you as a human know it. So it produces language that expresses purpose, even though it hasn't got one.
Yes.
Well, I think that's a nice point to land on. I think that's I think that really brings us nice full circle. So closing out, as we like to do in these conversations, let's have some of our takeaways. Mary, might you start us off today?
I'm going to answer as a woman of Greek background, for whom the idea of the human and the practices of the human really matter. And I don't think we can give that up so easily. And we must be very clear, clearly understand what we hang on to and what we think we can salvage from what's happening in ChatGPT.
Look, you know, this is really big and really, really interesting as a development. But I think what I want to say is, you know, we like this idea of cyber, which is feedback relationships. What it does, it doesn't replicate what humans could do, or less interestingly, is the replication than the possible complementary relationships. It knows every word that's ever been published. It can work out the relationship between all those things. That's an amazing tool that we've just invented, but its ways of summarizing and making sense of the world as a mechanism are very, very different from human mechanisms, and we call those mechanisms grammar, mightn't always be conscious, as Jim highlights so well. We operate grammatically in ways which are not conscious. You know, linguists give these things technical names, but ordinary users do grammar without being able to articulate it. But nevertheless, there is grammar there, which is these structures of human meaning along the way. And again, the point is, our argument is this is very different from statistical manipulation of Unicode, which has been reduced to binary notation.
And it's cybersocial.
Yeah, well, the phrase we use is cybersocial, which is rather than artificial intelligence, it's a cybersocial relationship, an interaction between humans and machines. And we've been doing that since we started using tools. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
And Jim, yourself, what's your takeaway today?
I fundamentally believe that humans are a screwed up species. One of the few species that will put themselves out of business faster in a shorter evolutionary time than any species lived on Earth. So something must be wrong with us. And I think what's wrong with us is we don't understand what sort of animal we are. What we are. And that's what's put us. That's why our schools are no good. We don't understand how humans really learn. We don't understand what a human really is. We have an elevated view of our own rationality and intelligence, which is leading us to deplete the world. So the biggest issue we can do now is use everything we can, including chat, to re-theorize who we are as a being before we put ourselves out of existence.
I agree fully with what you just said, and a Christian would put it in another way, but I don't think the solution is in ChatGPT.
No, not the solution. The solution is using ChatGPT and other things to help us see that the human is strange again and re-theorize, rethink what we are. This is already happening in the realm of emotion and feeling, revolution in how we think about ourselves and the role of emotion, and we got to go further.
Let's do it, Jim.
Well, I think I'm going to wrap my takeaway up very small and say simply that, yes, the learning process in our education systems, which are in very many ways broken, and I would agree entirely with what all of you are saying in that department, and also on the level of the human, just as you've beautifully put it there, Jim, that, I mean, hey, let's take a technology and let it reflect back upon ourselves and learn something for once, right?
Right.
We've missed you, Jim. It's wonderful
to miss you. Yeah. I don't get to do this much. Yay. It's good.
Well, let's do it again.
And we love
let's
you.
Let's do it again.
Jim. At least we love each other.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, that is all for our episode today of All We Mean. My guests today were, again, Bill Cope and Mary Calantes. And on today's show, we had James G. I'm Daniel Shea, signing out. Until next time here on Scholarly Communication.